back into another episode of Cult Film Cafe. Of course, it is me, Jonathan, one of your hosts, and as always, I am joined by my partner in crime, Kenzie.
Hello there.
So, sadly, on this episode, you're just going to have to listen to me and Kenzie. We do not have a guest, but I'm fairly confident that this is going to be a really, really good episode, as we are going to be talking about a film which I probably should have watched about 10 years ago when I got right into watching movies, but this gave me a chance to watch it. This is Sex, Lies and Videotape, written and directed by Steven Soderbergh.
It's the most provocative film of the year. Vincent Canby in the New York Times calls it one of the best of 89. Exceptionally accomplished and witty.
Being happy isn't all that great. I mean, the last time I was really happy, I got so fat.
The Los Angeles Times calls it brilliant, a delicate and sexually charged film. Rolling Stone says it's dazzling, fun, and scorchingly erotic.
Why don't you let me tape you?
Doing what? John and Ann don't have sex anymore.
And Time magazine calls it terrific. The season's smartest and funniest film.
Is it for me?
Yeah, it's for you.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Is that for me?
Yeah, it's for you.
A Miramax Films release.
So, if it's a first watch for me, it's probably a first watch for you.
Definitely, yep. In fact, I had never even heard of this film ever before. So,
wow, yeah. Wow. Kenzie's meant to be this film buff, but he just...
I honestly had never heard of this one. So, it was... And going into it, I didn't read anything about it at all. So, I just went straight into it, not knowing anything at all.
See, the thing about this one is strange because we've just done our Oscars predictions episodes, which we pretty much complained about the length of all of these films. And I feel as though this is a nice switch because it's a relatively short film and what you would expect, but maybe not for the time. Maybe it was the average film length back in the day. But I had a really good time watching this film. And it'll be interesting to see what your opinions on it is. Well, let's get right into it. The film was written and directed by Steven Soderbergh, who is probably more well known now for the Ocean's 11 trilogy. This was his feature film debut. It was released in the UK in late July 1989 and in the US early August in a limited capacity, but yeah, over subsequent weeks it did get a more sort of bigger capacity release in America. It's a pretty simple film, in all honesty. It's not a super complex narrative, but I would say that this film is more about the technical aspects of it over the script and the narrative, for me anyway.
Interesting. So I'm guessing you liked the film.
Yeah, I really did like this film, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so did I. I really liked this film. I honestly did not know what to expect. I was like, is this going to be good? Is this going to be bad? I was like, oh, look, there's James Spader. A lot younger, of course. Well, it is 1989. And I just didn't really know what this film was going to really be. And it was really interesting. You brought it. It's like, it's quite weird. It's I don't know, it just works really well, I guess. The characters in it all, they're not all likable, but they're all pretty good characters. How it ends up, like, everything ends up happening just seems to, I don't know, it just seems to work really well. It's really, it is weird. Like, the whole thing with James Spader's whole thing, I just, it's so odd, but they managed to make it really entertaining and make it a really good film. I honestly didn't think this was going to be that good, but it's actually like really good. Never mind that the fact that it's filmed very well as well. So yeah, I'm quite glad I bumped into this one. I would have never watched this if I didn't watch it for the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, this is a film that I have known about for a while, but I think I just put it off. I don't know, for whatever reason, maybe the title of the film just kind of threw me off a bit. It's a strange one. It's very, very kind of, there's only, a handful of people in this. I mean, yeah. It really revolves around four people. The film stars, obviously, as Kenzie mentioned, James Spader as Graham Dalton, Andy McDowell as Anne Bishop Mullaney, Peter Gallagher as John Mullaney, Laura San Giacomo as Cynthia Price Bishop, and then we've got Stephen Brill as the barfly and Ron Votter as the therapist. Very small cast, which you can kind of get from this. It's a really, really independent. This is like an indie film that was just made by now probably one of the most celebrated directors, or probably some people's favorite directors over the last 30 years. I really enjoyed this film, and like I said, this narrative is really, it's a strange film, well written, but it's not like a super complicated narrative. And if you go into this film looking for the next best story in a film that you've ever seen, you're not really going to be that happy with it, I don't think. But if you're somebody like me, this film's got so much in it, and I've watched this film so many times, like over the last week, and I keep asking myself why was the decision to do that? Why did they do that? Why did they use that shot? Why was the camera's always moving in this film? It's like always moving, whether it's subtly moving, it's just always moving.
It's quite weird, eh?
Did you notice that? It's like, even if it's like a slow pan, or like a dolly or a track shot, it's like really slow. But there is a perspective where it's like, is your camera's never really still on like a single, obviously on a frame, but like it's never really static. There's not that many static shots in the film. Whether that's the camera moving or the actors or the action moving, there's always movement all the time.
Yeah, there is. I never really fully noticed that. Yeah, I don't know why. That's an odd. I mean, I'm guessing there must have been a reason. Like, yeah, it's a bit.
Like, why does he? Like, this is the thing. Why did he? Like, so. Just deep dive the plot quickly. It's right. Pretty simple for me. I mean, in my opinion, I've just got basic notes. It kind of revolves around a married couple played by Andy McDowell and Peter Gallagher. And then what comes to fruition is Peter Gallagher's, like John's character, one of his old friends is coming into town. He's giving him a place to stay. And this is James Spader, Graham, who over the years, they've not seen each other for 9 years, he's became much different than what he probably was. And we don't really get to know what he was. I think there's times in the film where Anne's pushing him to kind of, like, towards the end to let her understand who he was, but you can tell that he's possibly been through some things and things have happened, or you get that kind of sense. He is quite a mysterious character. So when he kind of comes on the scene, things kind of start to fracture in their relationship. Not only that, but John's having an affair with Anne's sister, Cynthia. So that's already happening. Their relationship's really flawed. Anne's already in therapy. They don't have sex. They're not sleeping with each other. It's just a real complicated bit. Then when James Spader comes into this, like, everything kind of changes. And it's just for him. He's really captivating. I really like James Spader. This is a real young James Spader. He's got loads of hair. Now he's bald, and people are probably more familiar with him now from The Blacklist, the TV show, if you haven't seen that or checked out old films. I really like James Spader. Every time I see him in something, he's just really a captivating actor. And this character's really, really good. And obviously, it slowly kind of comes round that he videotapes or interviews and tapes conversations with women about sex, because that's his form of getting off, because he's now impotent and like he can't get an erection in front of other people. Yeah, he's just this film obviously lives and dies based on that character for me. If he isn't in it and it's not played by James Spader, I don't think it's as good a film. But yeah, how do you feel like the plot is? You know, it's pretty simple.
I mean, yeah,
it's kind of complicated as well. I don't know if I've done a real good explanation
like,
there, but
I know it is. There's not like too much to it. It is quite peculiar, but it is for the most part simple. It is. You've pretty much explained the whole thing. I forgot. John, he's having an affair. That's what you've. And then the wife. She is kind of weird, but she's in therapy, stuff like that. James Spader's character comes into it, Graham, and yeah, he's just peculiar. He's just. John quite clearly doesn't like him. I think Graham doesn't like John either. They're completely different now. He's like. It's kind of weird. The film starts you off with. Is her name Anne? Is Anne the wife?
Anne's the wife, yeah. Yeah. Andy McDowell.
It starts with her and like therapy. It kind of cuts between her and therapy and like James Spader driving to the location and stuff like that. But once he like arrives, the way he talks and stuff like that, it's almost similar to like, as a therapist talks almost.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite weird. But eventually you start kind of. You get like a few times like Anne starts getting quite interested in Graham, and all of a sudden once she figures out about this whole videotape thing, I think it completely freaks her out. But eventually like her sister gets taped, which
yeah,
that kind of shows you a little bit of what these tapes are like, and it's really it's kind of weird, like the way that Graham interviews, he's like asking the questions and he moves about a lot. That's another thing, he moves about a lot in this film when they go do interviews. It's the same as like the camera kind of moves a lot as well, like in pans and stuff like that. It's just which eventually leads to, well, it takes a lot before Anne eventually does it as well, but then eventually everything else that happens, I feel like kind of Graham can be quite absent from this film at times. Like he's in it, he's got a lot of screen time in it, but once like, there's certain parts of it where he's in it a lot. And you might not see him for a little bit, and he comes back. Because it does mainly focus on everyone else's perspective more. You don't really see from his perspective in this film at all, really. It's more when other people interact with him is when you see him. And you really don't know much about him until you get to the end of the film. He's very, like, Jonathan's right, he's very mysterious. But then that final part of the film, which is the final part of this film, was really good. I didn't actually know how this film was going to go. But that final part, when you get to see the interview between Anne and Graham, it's very good. And suddenly things start coming out about Graham, and you start to kind of understand him more or somewhat anyway. I'm still a bit slightly confused. But he's changed a lot, and he's clearly struggling with things, but so is Anne, and Anne's kind of saying that she could also help. It just works really well. Also the music, so far I've not brought up the music in this film. I think the music in this film goes really well with it. It's not like the best music you'll ever hear, but like for the film, I think it fits so well. It's very kind of, for the most part, slow and kind of weird. It gives this weird, kind of almost eerie feel to it. But it just kind of works. I the whole thing is, you never truly know Graham at the start, and like as it goes on, you really don't know if he's just going to be like a complete fucking weirdo or what.
Yeah, this is what I was going to ask you. He's got a lot of tropes that you would expect potentially in a horror movie character.
Yes.
But this is definitely not a horror movie. It's got that kind of eerie feel. I know what you're talking about. And there's a lot of weird technical choices. So when he first goes into the house, so he arrives.
Yes.
We'll go back to the start of the film in a minute or two. We'll talk about he arrives, Anne's at home, he goes in, they kind of have a weird exchange, they kind of stand off as she doesn't really want him there. He probably knows that he's not fully welcome, so there's that kind of, and he's quite abrupt. He's kind of got quite an abrupt nature, and he kind of asks where the bathroom is, gives her strawberries. I don't know why you would bring somebody strawberries, but anyway, it does in this. It's like a gift. Obviously, didn't go to town. It comes back, and there's this kind of weird juice because they have the kind of conversation about Anne's marriage. He asks a few kind of maybe imposing questions that she probably wasn't expecting, and then it cuts to this high angle shot when he's walking to the toilet when he finally goes. Why did they do that? Because do you know what I mean? It's like, because normally when you do that in a film, it's like it's to show a sense of weakness in characters. Now, are they meant to be the weak characters then? Because there's a shot of John in his office kind of not long after this or not long before this, where it's a low angle shot, so it puts him in the dominant sphere of he's the power. But over time the film switches and he slowly loses like everything, like John's character essentially. I mean, this film must only span about 3 or 4 days, because I picked up on it that he keeps putting off a meeting to Friday, and yes, he eventually has the meeting at the end of the film. So, I mean, it can't have lasted a week. So what is it, like 2 or 3 days? Is that how quick, like a marriage was dissolving into madness and this kind of mysterious figure would come in and change everybody? Because it doesn't only have a profound effect on their relationship. He also has there's a thing in the film where after Cynthia goes to see him, they have this, she phones John and he comes round in his sleep, but it's kind of a really cool cut because Graham's watching the video back.
Yes.
And then it cuts to her, like, in a euphoric moment. And my mind is, he's had a profound effect on her as well, and I don't think she really wants to sleep with John. I think she really wants to sleep with Graham, but Graham doesn't want to sleep with anybody currently. So she's just kind of using it because she's that amped up from their experience.
It's a real, yeah. I think that's the last time.
Clever
as well, yeah.
Trick. Like, yeah, it was the last time, and after that, it's like she's like, nah, I don't like you anymore. It's quite strange.
It completely
There's
changed
a lot
almost.
Of great editing techniques. The way they kind of cut between the videotape to that, and there's a bit later on where it's like the Anne videotape, and then it kind of blocks out from her shoulder, and it goes into the perspective of live when they were taping. This is the thing about being the technical aspects of this film for me are just mesmerizing. As somebody who would like to work in the film industry and potentially direct films, and to see somebody able to do that in a debut, not only that, I mean, the script was written in 8 days.
Really?
Which, blows my mind. Every time I hear this, when they go, oh, this film was written in 8 days or a week, and I'm like, fuck off. Like, seriously? Like, there's other examples of it. It's not just this one. Like, this was written in 8 days. But we touched upon it in the Breakfast Club episode. John Hughes apparently wrote the Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller's scripts in under a week. Right? Not only that, I found other examples. Rocky in 16 Candles, and Rocky, Sylvester Stallone in 16 Candles, another John Hughes movie, 2 to 3 days. Scream, 3 days. Taxi Driver, 2 weeks. Swingers, John Favreau, under 2 weeks. Barton Fink, the Coen Brothers movie, 3 weeks. Do the Right Thing, Spike Lee, 2 weeks. Cabin in the Woods, we done it in the Halloween episode, 3 to 4 days. I'm like, how the fuck are they able to do that?
Some people are just really good screenwriters. I don't know. I feel like at a certain point, I mean, what's quite bizarre is some of those films, it's like debut films, like Do the Right Thing. That's Spike Lee's first film.
Yep. This is Steven Soderbergh's first film.
That's Steven Soderbergh. It's like, that's crazy. Taxi Driver was an early one for Scorsese.
It wasn't written by Scorsese, though.
Was it not?
No. I forget who the screenwriter was for Taxi Driver. I should have written that down for my research. I think it was written by Paul Schrader. Yeah, Paul Schrader wrote the script.
Scorsese
directed it. But yeah, still, I mean, that's a much more complex narrative than this film. But I'm pretty sure 16 Candles was John Hughes' first movie. And it took, what, a couple of days to write, apparently?
Right.
And I'm like, well, how do people do it? Like,
I think the Rocky one's quite impressive.
Rocky, Sylvester Stallone, because nobody ever thinks, like, see, now Sylvester Stallone's just an action star and a movie star and stuff like that. But I think he's kind of more clever. You know, he directed, he wrote Rocky. It was all his idea, man.
How he came up from
made him think.
Rocky.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, he was, like, homeless, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He was, and, yeah.
And
I don't know if he
didn't want him at all.
Yeah, I don't know if he probably went for quite a few different, like, writing different scripts, but I think eventually he wrote Rocky, and they were very interested in it. And he was like, nah, I want to be in it, and they really didn't want him, because they thought no one would understand him. And stuff, but they actually, I don't know how he managed to convince them that to like make him be in it and stuff like that, but they did, and it worked.
I mean, you can't think of Rocky without Sylvester Stallone now.
I mean, yeah, like, they're still making films in the franchise today. In fact, yeah. One just came out.
Well, is it out now or just about to come out? Something
it's
like
either just about out or it's out. I can't remember.
Creed 3 is just about to drop.
Sylvester's not in it, sadly, but.
But this is Michael B. Jordan's directorial debut, this film.
It is, yes. It's quite interesting.
Yeah.
Do you know Sylvester Stallone does not own Rocky at all? Yeah, he was making a lot of posts about it recently. He's not very happy about it, which is fair.
It is fair, but at the end of the day, people end up selling off IP. At the time, he probably signed a bum contract because he had no money. I mean, if he had the amount of money he's got now, he would have sold it. No, it is what it is. Like, people are in weird positions of power. Like, look at when Disney bought Lucasfilm. George Lucas still had enough power because he has to keep all the merchandise rights and stuff. So he didn't sell everything. He sold the kind of film rights, essentially. So that's another thing. I wanted to touch back on the opening. It happens a lot in the film where the use of L cuts and J cuts in this movie is, I don't know if it's disorientating, and I don't know if I necessarily like it or I would use it myself, but obviously it's done to great effect here. It happens right from the get-go. Like, we have audio from a scene that we don't see, and then it cuts to that scene, and it still cuts back, and it does it even when the audio starts playing in the scene before it hasn't finished. What do you think about J and L cuts, personally?
I think they can work really well in films. I think it works in this film. It's noticeable in this film, which is interesting.
Yes.
I'm guessing that's what the director wanted. They do it quite a lot, and I think it works for this film. It's kind of a weird thing. I don't know who first came up with the idea of like changing like shot while having the same audio or doing like the kind of. Well, doing the opposite, that's the same thing, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what way around it is, but the J and L cut are basically opposites of each other.
Does it happen often in this film, where, like, the audio changes, but the shot's still the same?
It does happen a few times, yeah. That's what I'm saying about technical choices. This is an editing choice, it's still a technical choice when you make a film. This is the thing, is like, I put down in my notes that I feel as though this is Steven Soderbergh making a movie, but the film wasn't shot by him. It was shot by Walt Lloyd. So the cinematographer in this film wasn't Steven Soderbergh. But I feel as though the directors kind of are cinematographers in their own right, but they maybe just don't hold the camera. But in a film like this, a short, small film, surely Soderbergh would have manned a camera at some point.
I would think so.
But Walt Lloyd's been on to have a great career. I mean, he worked with Soderbergh on this film and again on Kafka. Then he worked with legendary filmmaker Robert Altman in Shortcuts in the early 90s. He's had a career. I mean, it's nowhere near a Steven Soderbergh career. And he's not a cinematographer that I'm aware of. But he has worked on some quite really good films. But then again, it kind of goes back. A director like Steven Soderbergh is so kind of built on technical elements rather than what I would call like an auteurship, that this feels just like him on film. Not only that, like, apparently each of the four main characters are based on a part of his personality, like a separate part of him. Huh. So there's not one representation of him. They all kind of add up to accumulate to him as a person, which is quite a cool way of writing if you've got that. I mean, and he's obviously, this is influenced by a lot of him growing up and stuff as well. I was quite scared coming into this podcast because I asked you if you'd watched the film and you said yes. And this is the first time that I've asked you if you liked it and you've went, I'm saving it for the podcast. Normally you tell me and I was like, oh, yeah. Fuck, is he going to hate this film?
I'm going to hate it.
And I'm kind of glad that you like it. Because,
I really like it, honestly. Yeah. I think it's like a really good film. I was watching it, I was like, this is quite good. And I kept going on, I was like, this is really good. This is how have I never heard of this film before? It was kind of shocked me. It's like a film with like James Spader in it, and I'm like, I've never heard of this at all. It's very good. It is. Like, I really do recommend this to like anyone, really. It's a very good watch. It's very interesting. It's mm-hmm. kind of a simple-ish plot, but it is really interesting. I don't know, there's something about it. It's just everything, the way the characters act in the film, the way the interviews are done, it's just, I don't know, how everything comes out in like kind of the end. It's just,
yeah, I mean, that's a funny one. I've just realised that this film is edited by Steven Soderbergh. So,
right,
written,
okay.
Directed, edited, probably, I mean, being a director, you'd tell the cinematographer what you want, what shot you want. I mean, also, this film had me stopping, like, all the time and Googling. Like, I know we both done the same course at college, right? I mean, you're going back this year, hopefully. I don't know if you've heard anything yet. As people know, I was at uni at some point last year, dropped out, but I'm going back. I've got offers again to go back this year to go. And even though we've studied film and we've done it and we've done film theory and stuff like that at college, it was still tricking me because I was like, what is he doing? Like, so the dolly shots or tracking shots, I would call it a tracking shot, but I mean, the whatever terminology you want. I was trying to work out whether it was actually the whole camera moving or he was just doing like a slow zoom, like a really slow zoom.
Right.
And I'm
okay.
Like, but the perspective doesn't, like, in a zoom, it's like the whole kind of, everything gets zoomed in. Whereas if you do a tracking shot, like out to in or in to out, the perspective, you can keep the subject in frame and stuff. And it feels like you're just going by people. And there's not that many times where you're kind of walking by subjects, but it kind of struck me in a bit where Cynthia and Graham, they're having their interview and she's sitting on the couch and he's on the armchair, but you can just see kind of his shoulder and stuff. The camera, ever so slowly, is just moving in and in and in and in to her.
Yes.
And obviously there gets to a point where he gets up off, to Kenzie's point, he's always moving, he gets up off the seat and then lies on the floor and they're kind of mirroring each other. It's strange. And then it cuts to, like, they do a good job of cutting to the actual videotape in this. Mm-hmm. Like, and it looks great. Like, I know people watch this and go, I don't really like the way this film looks. And I'm like, well, for me, I love the way this film looks. Like, it is so, so good. And they use it well. And there's not a lot of videotape shown. It's like the first part we get with Graham and when Anne comes over, he's watching one. But apart from that, the only other videotapes that we get to see are Cynthia's one for one part, like a very short kind of time, and then Anne's. But Anne's is played longer because at this point, Anne's found out that John's cheating on her with, well, she knows it's her sister. So she goes over and makes a tape. And then, I mean, she kind of is out at this point of her marriage, and they have an altercation where she says to John, I want out, and he just wants to know if she's made one of these tapes, and she does. Obviously he goes over and basically puts the tape on. I don't necessarily know if I would want to do that, because you end up seeing what you see, and what you end up seeing is just how much of a connection that's not necessarily always physical. I feel like it ends up being physical because the tape gets turned off, and yeah. I feel as though at that point Graham and Anne are about to do something that you'll never see. It's up to your interpretation, but that's my reading of it. But I don't know if I'd want to see that as a husband whose wife has not wanted to be physical with them for a number of months, years, whatever, how long, we don't know. And just this random person arrives, and within 5 days, she's totally, like, changed and has become this kind of person that wants to experience these things.
Yeah, I don't actually fully know how John felt about the tape. He watches the entire thing, and he's really angry when he first goes over. Like, he punches Graham in the face, goes in, locks the door, puts the tape on once he finds it. It looked like he was going to watch both tapes, but I think he only watches Anne's. And yeah, at the very end of it, after it cuts to him, I don't know. It's weird how it affected him. Mm-hmm. I honestly didn't know how he was going to take it. Eventually, it looked like he had even teared up a little bit, but I'm not even too sure about that. It's kind of weird. But he comes out and he's just so much calmer, and he speaks to Graham a little bit about this person that, what's her name?
Is it Laura? I want to say Laura, but Laura. It might not be.
Maybe it's like Laura or something like that. She's not actually in the film, but Graham obviously had something with her years before, but I don't know, we don't know how it went or what, but he still seems to be, what's the word? He still seems to be interested in her, I guess. I don't know. It's kind of weird. He just tells her I think at that point John just tells her that he slept with her once before when they were still together, and that's all he could really say about her. And
he's still kind of being this kind of smug, I get what I want kind of character, and that slowly kind of, that his world kind of collapses pretty quick.
I feel like at that moment he was just trying to tell her like he's maybe wasting his time or what. I don't know what but after that Graham like what smashes all the tapes, eh?
Yeah, wrecks all the tapes, kind of smashes his camera, flings it out. It's obviously like an epiphany moment for him. Because I think that maybe seals the deal, because I feel as though his impotency and whatever's happened with him psychologically had something to do with... Well, the thing is, when he's talking to Anne when they're filming, Anne does the whole turning the tapes thing, which never obviously happens. He's in control of all these other interviews. And I think it's because she really likes him, but she wants to know why he's like it. And he gets really uncomfortable, but he speaks about the way he used to be. Like, he used to act out, like, he wasn't a verbal communicator, he was a physical communicator. And that kind of, you can read into that he'd maybe done something in his past that he's not happy with, and it's affected him psychologically. And over the past 9 years, he's changed, and he's kind of tried to be a better person or a better version of himself, but he also admits that he's a pathological liar.
Yeah.
And it's like, for him, it's like an addiction, it's like alcoholism, and he's trying to get better, but it is difficult. And I think what he's doing helps him, but I don't know how it helps him, because only he'll know and the character knows. It's quite a strange one. But whatever Anne does and whatever Graham does, they've obviously got a chemistry together. And I feel as though at the end of the film, it looks as though they've ended up together, which I'm not necessarily sure, because the film cuts pretty much there. You don't get like what happens 2 days later, you know. It's a strange one. I don't know. How do you feel? Do you feel like they're now together, they're kind of coupled up, or do you think they're just friends?
I don't know. I think it's very open. I think they'll probably end up together, but at that point, it's really too early to tell.
Yeah, because I feel like they're both kind of deeply troubled people. They've got their own problems. Like, because Anne, we know that she does. Well, she was seeing a therapist, and that there was mention of that. She asked. She kind of assumed that Graham would have been in therapy, but he isn't. But maybe this, the interviewing and videotaping's his form. His I feel like it is, form, it is his form of therapy. Like you prefaced, he does speak like a therapist. It's very slow and methodic. And he seems to always be in control, which maybe is a what he wouldn't have been when he was younger, you know? Maybe erratic and stuff. It's a strange one. It's a really, really good film. Like, even the narrative to me is actually pretty strong. Like, but I feel as though it's more the technical aspects that keep me questioning, you know? And, like, this film's always moving. Do you have anything else that you would like to bring up and say, or...?
No, I think I'm good. I just really like the film. I like all the characters. Well, I don't like John, but, like, I think he's a good character and how he's portrayed in the film. I highly recommend this one for anyone who's not seen it. It's I think anyone could watch this film and possibly like it. I was recommending it to my mum and stuff like that to watch it, because it's a really good film. I think she would really enjoy it.
She likes, what is that Netflix show? Is it You? The mad creepy one?
Oh, You's really good. I like You. You's so good.
Because there's like an element of creep in this, you know, like Graham, James Spader. But no, he's kind of like a lovable creep, which is kind of weird to say out loud.
Yes, it's quite weird with Graham, because see, at first, I didn't know if I liked him.
Yeah.
I didn't like how prying he was. Like, see, when you first meet him, he's straight away asking these questions that are like, why are you asking, like, these, like, how's your marriage? That's a weird question. Like, I feel like some people would take that question the wrong way. If you know what I mean? Because, what is that truly, what are you truly asking here? Like, what?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. It was prying, but I think it's his inquisitive nature. It's just, it's kind of what he's interested in. But no, last thing I would like to touch on, not only was the script written in 8 days, the film was shot in a month. That's normally due to budget constraints. It's not necessary. I think if he got 10 times the budget, he might have shot over 2 or 3 months. There was a week of rehearsals and a month-long shoot. It was filmed in August 1988, and basically it was the only reason for that was it had a small budget. And the funny thing is it's that Steven Soderbergh's come out and said it's the only movie that he's ever made where he felt like he had all the money and all the time he needed to make it. And he's went on to make much bigger budget films, which have had a much longer window of time to direct and produce. But I think with those, there is always an element of the studio wants it finished as soon as possible. They don't want... And I think maybe doing a small independent film, there's a lot of pressure to kind of taken off that way.
I mean, I guess it's true. Since it's a kind of simple film, it's probably a lot easier to actually make and film it. Whereas, like, when you're doing a film, like, say, for instance, Ocean's 11, where you've got quite a big budget to do it, but you've got a lot of, like, complex things to do in the film, and you've got to try and get everything right and make sure it works. You've got a lot more people to work with. It's just a lot more of a stressful situation than doing a small independent film.
Yeah, I think it's, like, one of those, like, these independent films, like, I know that, like, Steven Soderbergh, it was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay for this, a BAFTA for Best Original Screenplay. Obviously, I've spoke about the supporting actress stuff, but it's at Cannes where this film kind of done its damage, like, won the Palme d'Or, won the Fipresi Prize, James Spader won Best Actor. I think film festivals like that, and obviously Sundance is kind of another famous one. I think that this film premiered at Sundance in early 89. Obviously went to Cannes, and by the end of the summer, it had a theatrical release. But yeah, I think films like this do well at the kind of those awards shows rather than the kind of major ones.
Yeah, absolutely.
It won the Audience Award at Sundance Film Festival as well. But anyway, that is enough about the film. I think we should just round this up and kind of give it our rating out of 5 popcorn buckets like we do here on the podcast. Me first, you first.
I'll go first. I knew nothing about this film going in. I didn't bother looking at anything. I was just go straight in empty, not knowing what to expect from this film. And I was very, I don't know, surprised the word. I don't know, I just, from the title of the film, I was expecting this film to be kind of weird and not that good. I actually thought this film was going to be older than it actually was, for some reason. Don't really know why. But going into it, it was a lot different from what I expected, and I actually really enjoyed it. This film is a good watch. It's quite short. It's only like, what, 1 hour 40? Round about that mark.
It's an hour 40, like, total, but that's including credits and stuff.
So it's like an hour, what, 39, like, just, less than that, to be honest.
It's like about an hour 30, hour 31, 32, by the time the credits roll. Something like that.
Yeah. I will say it feels a little bit longer than that, but it definitely doesn't drag. It does, I just say, it feels like it was not... like a kind of 90-minute film. Feels just a bit longer. I mean, I guess it technically is, because it's like 8 minutes longer than like a kind of 90-minute, but it feels just like a slight bit longer, but the film doesn't drag at all. The film, like, I wasn't expecting to like it very much. I actually did like it a lot. I think this is a really good film. Everything about this film just kind of works. You just don't... And it all... I mean, Jonathan's right, it all really revolves around James Spader's character being really good and being played very well, because he kind of carries a lot of the film, because it's about his effect on everyone else in this film that it makes it so kind of interesting. His whole kind of stick of, like, the videotapes, which is just the most bizarre thing you've probably seen in some films, and it could be portrayed very, very weird. I mean, it kind of is. I mean, it is, but it's weird. You can see it's weird, but, like, it could have made him out to be, like, super weird, whereas, oddly enough, he actually isn't. I mean, he's weird, but he's, like, not, like, he's not, isn't, he doesn't seem, like, crazy or, like, anything like that. It's just, they portray it in a really interesting way. And the characters, I've never seen a character like this in a film. He's so different. The way he talks, like, he's literally, he's always, it's question, very soft-spoken. Although he is, like, asking these, like, kind of prying questions, he doesn't seem like he's kind of nice about it, and it's, in the film, like, causes a lot of the characters to kind of open up on tapes and stuff like that when they do it. It's a very good film, which I think the conclusion for me was my favourite part. I think that final interview, watching that, makes the film even better. It's just, and the film was already good up until that point. Very good performances, filmed very well. The music gives it a nice eerie tone to it. I think that's what really worked for me, is that everything feels just a bit weird, and it's just kind of, things kind of feel offish, but it's like, it's almost getting to the almost horror-y vibe, but it's just not there. It's just something, it's just this weird thing. Like, I don't even know what genre would you fully call this film. It's quite interesting and slightly kind of weird. But I recommend it. I think most people will enjoy this film. It's different and very good. For a directorial debut, that's amazing. And with a budget as well, you gotta watch this one. I'd probably give it a solid 4. It's a very good film, and I did very much enjoy it.
Yeah, great film. So I'll just give kind of my final thoughts on it. I just wanted to say, like, I'm not going to beat around the bush and say that if you're looking for one of the best pieces of narrative writing in cinema, then, I mean, you will be disappointed with this film, but this film's got a lot more to love. I mean, for me, there's a lot of technical things and choices that he makes that always have me asking why, and that's why I love this film so much. And purely for somebody like me who is an aspiring filmmaker, I'm not gonna beat around the bush. Like, I would love to make films. this film has got everything I want in it. You know, just why did they do it? If I'm constantly asking that in a film, it has totally got me on lock, like, and I'll watch it. Like I said, I've watched this numerous times before we've recorded. So yeah, for me, this is easily one of the best films I've watched so far off the list. And like I said earlier, I should have got around to watching this about 10 years ago or so. And like I said then, probably the title put me off. I don't know why. It's just kind of funny because I told the guy that I worked with that I was going to be recording a podcast on a film called Sex, Lies and Videotape. And he just looked at me as if I was doing some form of porno or something.
Yeah, I know.
And I was like, that's not what it is, mate. And he then told me I should watch a film called Dave Made a Maze that's on Netflix. And a guy makes a maze out of cardboard boxes. I'm like, mate, we're a million miles
what
apart.
What is that?
Exactly. Anyway, this is what I'm saying. If you, anybody listening, if you've got any inclination that you ever want to make films in your life, you need to watch this film. Like, you have to. It's a piece of, like, as I've written, it's a piece of overly technical wizardry from one of the best directors of the last 30 years. And I've learned more from watching this film than I could ever say and get across. It's been a fantastic viewing pleasure. This is one of these films that no matter how many times you watch it, for me, I will always be analysing it differently. I'll always pick up on subtle little things that I'll probably change my opinion of it and the reading that I have of the film. And for me, that is genius filmmaking. So for me, this is a 4.5 out of 5. And over time, this could even be a 5 out of 5 for me. But I'm comfortable giving it a 4.5 at the moment. But like I said, whenever we do a recap in 20 more episodes, this could potentially be in the top 10. Like, this film is so good. I had so much pleasure watching it, and I'm glad that you liked it also. So yeah,
it's a very good film.
It's a really good film, and yeah, I can't say it enough. Please watch it. Like, it's really good. And if you don't enjoy it, come back at us and say, oh, that was shit. But yeah, it was, for us, it's a terrific piece of filmmaking.
It won't be for everyone, I bet, but like, I feel like the people who will like it will like it a lot.
Anyway, that is it for this section of the podcast. That is a 4 for Kenzie, it's a 4.5 for me. Let's move on to the rules. So yeah, kick off the rules segment. We will talk about low budget stroke box office flop. Now, film was produced. Yeah, we've kind of touched on it. The film was produced on a budget of $1.2 million, and it went on to gross a total of $36.7 million. In 2023, adjusted for inflation, that would be a $3 million budget, and the gross would be just over $93 million.
So yeah, definitely a small budget, but that's a huge making money.
Yeah. Like, the return on investment is incredible. It's a strange
thing with small budget films, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the thing. Like I said before, I mean, it was theatrically released in sort of late summer, late July, early August, 1989, and that was obviously off the back of how successful it was at both Sundance and Cannes, where it won the Palme d'Or, which we've already said. Initially, the film in the US, it's hard to find UK statistics, the US numbers, it opened in only 4 screens in its opening weekend, and it grossed $155,000, which was which made it the number 16 film. But by the end of September, the film was in over 500 screens and became a sleeper hit at the box office, and it had its peak week coming over the Labor Day weekend, where it grossed just over $3.4 million. That's when it entered the top 10, and it stayed there for 6 more weeks.
Wow.
So yeah, this film, as it opened and became a kind of a bigger release, started to make decent amounts of money, and yeah, it was a top 10 film for a period in 1989, and yeah, it just goes to show you that you don't need to make multi-million dollar films to be successful. You keep the budget small and your return on investment can be relatively high. Just look at this, 30 times the amount of money spent was gained back. So yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've got anything else to add to this.
No, I think this one's kind of cut and dry. It's a very small budget, but it did actually. It's kind of one of those half and half films, isn't it? It hits one of the ones of this question, but not both of them. Which I feel like a lot of these films do. I feel like a lot of these films are either big budget, no money, or like small budget, big money. Or
well, that's the whole point. You'll never get your the likelihood that you find in a low budget film that that's been a proper flop is pretty slim. So the reason it's low budget or box office flop is to kind of catch both sort of polar opposites of films. We're looking for the low budget films that they can make as much money as they want, but they're still low budget. Or we're trying to catch the films that were really expensive but totally bombed.
What kind of shocks me though is like it done very well in like the box office.
Yep.
This film was like not talked about at all. Now. Like I had never heard of it. Like you had heard of it.
We should bring it back.
Bring it back.
I feel as though this film should be one of these films that probably is taught about or spoken about in colleges and universities. And if it isn't, it should be, because there's a lot of elements in this film that you could easily kind of break down in film theory. I would have loved to have had this film pop up in film theory at college, actually. But our lecturer is more of a Coen Brothers / PTA fan, so we got Raising Arizona instead. Hello, Drew, if you're listening. We are talking about you. But yeah, no, not to say that Raising Arizona is a bad film. I just think this film's better. In my opinion, I probably shouldn't say that out loud, but yeah. Everybody's going to have their own sort of fans of the sort of independent filmmakers, you know. It's just very cut and dry. I've just got written here, the film easily qualifies as a low-budget film, even though it was a major success at the box office, when you consider the film's budget to box office gross numbers. So yeah, it's an easy tick for this one. So move on to rewatchability. Ultimately, I've got this one as, for me personally, like you can only give your own opinion here, I suppose, but I mean, I've already watched this film like four times since my first watch, and it's about just like run times, an hour 40 minutes including credits, actual watch time, you're just over an hour and a half, so it easily fits the kind of 90 minute-ish length that we talk about. Anywhere between like an hour and a half and an hour and 45, yeah, they're kind of rewatchable lengths. So for me, and also James Spader's performance, I mean, I can't wax and lyrical about it, but for me, the performance that he gives in this makes it highly rewatchable for me personally, because his demeanor and performance, every time I've watched it, I've kind of seen something different, and that's what I like.
When we always look at this part, it's usually, I feel like a lot of it is preference of like if it's rewatchable or not, but the first thing we always look at is length, because length can tell you everything about it. So if it's a dragon film, you're not going to go back to it straight away. This film's a good length, and I think you get a lot from it every time you rewatch it. I feel like Jonathan's watched it, 4 or 5 times, and each time he's learned new things about the film and got more out of it. I think that's just true. For this film, it is quite a rewatchable film. I think if I gave this a rewatch, I would get more out of it the second time as well. It's just, because not everything in this film is fully cut and dry as well. So like I feel like you could miss something and next time watching it, notice that in some of the dialogue or something, or just anything about it, or the way it's filmed. If you're interested in that, you can now notice like things that you never noticed before, which for some people would be quite interesting. So yeah, it's absolutely a rewatchable film.
Yeah,
I just completely agree with that.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say, the reason we speak about watch time or length, it's like the investment of time. Time for people is, I mean, it's precious. I shouldn't say that, but people don't have a lot of time these days. We're just fresh off our Oscars podcast, and fucking 2.5 to 3 hour movies are just not that great to sit and watch through. And I just wanted to preface that, I mean, one of the podcasts that I listen to about films, they were talking about it, and the producer of that podcast, the two hosts, or the host and the guest, were going, it's an 85 minute movie, and even he was like, I'm sold. He was like, I'll watch any film that's 85 minutes long. And that just goes to show you, you know, if it's like an hour, 25 minutes, hour 30, like, most people will give it a go.
Whereas That's how I feel right now.
Exactly, but if you turn around to somebody and go, like, let's watch Babylon, I'd be like, mate, I don't know if I really want to sit for 3 hours and 10 minutes.
To watch a possibly shite film?
Well, I mean, that swings and roundabouts. So another podcast I listen to about film, one of the hosts on that, loves Babylon and thinks it's one of the best films of the last year. And I'm like, I don't know. But then again, he has, the Jordan Peele film, which I haven't watched, so I can't really comment. He thinks it's the best film of 2022. And I was speaking to somebody that's been on this podcast, Taz, was talking about it, and he was like, shite. Now, just subjective viewpoint, isn't it? Like, one's a guy who is a journalist and talks about and writes about movies, and the other guy's just a person that's a viewer and watched the film. I think people come at it from different angles, but yeah, I don't know why I went off on that tangent. Anyway, rewatchability, length matters in this category. This film hits the criteria. Not only that, it's a really, really enjoyable rewatch. So yeah, it's a yes for this one. Quotability.
I'm not going to lie, I don't really have anything for this one. Like, nothing fully stands out. I guess the barfly says a few things, but even off the top of my head, I'm not entirely sure about what he's actually saying. But he has a few kind of lines that are kind of funny. I don't even know why the barfly is even in the film. He's just in it for like a slightly comedic moment every time you're at the bar. Mm-hmm. He's always there. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I think it's one of these films that where I think there's some lines of dialogue that I really love, but like we spoke about in previous episodes, it's not got that kind of one-liner or a couple of those one-liners where
that kind of cheesiness to it. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's got really, really good bits. The bit that sticks with me the most is at the end. Well, at the end of the film, where Graham's interviewing Anne, so they've decided she wants to do a video tape, but she's turning the tables and she's kind of prying, and it's like she keeps badging him, and he turns around and he's like, "You're right, I've got a lot of problems, but they belong to me." And I think everybody feels that way. You know, everybody has got a lot of problems, and problems are really difficult to talk about. But her rebuttal to that was, "You think they're yours, but they're not." And then the conversation kind of flips there, and she's like, "Every single person that you have had contact with, it changes them, you know." And you just look at the film; that's kind of what's happened in that scenario. Everything that he's done has had a cause and effect on other people around him. And I think sometimes people get so wrapped up in their own world that they don't necessarily see what things that they do or the kind of decisions that they are choosing to make because of things that are possibly going on, how much that affects other people. And it's, do you know what? It's one of those things. This film was made over 30 years ago. I mean, this film came out pretty much round about the time when I came into the world. This film's slightly younger than me, believe it or not. Technically not, actually, because it was filmed in 1988, but in terms of release date, like, theatrically, yeah. But a film that was written over 30 years ago, and just how poignant a line of dialogue can be about the way people kind of act now, you know. And this is forefront of kind of mental health, and there's a big push now, and you can tell that a couple of these characters that were written over 30 years ago are struggling with things mentally. You can tell that Anne's fucking massively OCD and kind of got loads of shit going on in her head, and obviously Graham, James Spader's character's got loads of shit that he's trying to work through. They might not be doing it in the healthiest way. Maybe she is going to a therapist and he's trying to give himself therapy. And like I said, I'm not saying that, I wouldn't say that this is a quotable film, but there is lines of dialogue in this which I feel hit kind of really quite hard. Like, also, the time where it's mostly when Graham and Anne are on screen, I suppose, they have these kind of conversations.
Yeah.
It's like they cut to the bit where they're in a cafe or a restaurant or a diner or something, they're having a drink, and it's after they've went out looking for houses. And it's quite a weird cut because it's the scene directly before that is John and Cynthia having sex in the marital bed, and it cuts to Graham and Anne having a conversation, and Anne wants to know a secret, and they both kind of share, and that's the kind of where the kind of bomb was dropped. And he just, see the way that he turns around and just goes, "I'm impotent," just very abruptly, as if that's a normal thing to say to somebody. It's quite a strange one. It's quite a weird interaction. But he says at that part, during that conversation, that that he read somewhere that men learn to love the people that they are attracted to, but that women become more and more attracted to the person that they love. It's polar opposites. And I think that's just, see what I'm saying? It's just subtle bits of dialogue, which I really quite like. I'm not necessarily saying it's quotable, but I can understand why. But like I said, just a well-written film. I think it's like, it still baffles me the fact that he wrote it in 8 days.
Yeah, same here. Good dialogue, but it's not exactly the most quotable. Just good lines, and you can, if you looked into it, you could easily find a few lines that are good, but nothing that you could really quote out in in certain places. It's
I quite like how,
but not all films meant to do that.
No, that's true. And also the metaphor, the one key metaphor, I love that. See when he goes on about, "I just like having one key."
Yeah, the key thing. Yeah, I was actually thinking about bringing that up. Yeah,
it's so good. It's like, but if I get a house that's two keys. And then John's like, "We get rid of the car," but he's like, "But the car means something because it's his way of moving." Like, there's a lot to do about moving in this film. Whether the camera's moving, the people are moving, they're trying to run away, they're moving. It's like movement's a thing. He's like, he needs that. He couldn't get rid of the car, obviously, but yeah, I want the one key. I don't know. It's quite a strange one.
Why is he always drinking iced tea as well?
Well, he doesn't always drink iced tea. He runs out of iced tea at the end. He runs out of water. But yeah, he's always,
actually laughed at
always
that.
Drinking iced tea. Yeah.
So I'm out of iced tea now. Just
got water.
This instead.
It's got like a gallon weird shaped bottle of water.
Is it water? Is it lemonade? I don't know what it is.
It's water.
It's just water.
It's just water, aye. But why is he always drinking iced tea? I've no idea.
I don't even know. He just likes it. So there was no Kool-Aid.
There was no. Oh, fuck's sake. Yeah.
I don't know. I was just kind of, it's a kind of weird thing. It's always like, do you want a drink? It's not just, I want a drink. It's like, do you want some iced tea?
You see, it's weird things. Like, he's obviously very comfortable talking about sex because obviously he brought up his impotent, with the impotent. That's also another bit. See, when him and Anne are doing the videotape, and he just casually turns around and goes, "Do you have orgasms?" And it's like, what a weird question to ask somebody. But then again, he is asking about people's sex lives. It's like, and he asked Cynthia, "Have you ever been in television?" Or did they ask Anne that? No, he asked Anne that, "Have you ever been on TV?" That was like the first thing he asked her.
Yeah.
It's strange, yeah. What a fucking weird guy. The more and more I think about him as a character, the more and more I'm getting weirder. It's like weirding me out more and more.
He seems kind of scary almost at first, and kind of want to stay away from him, but he actually is harmless. It's kind of weird. I think he just says what is in his head.
Another thing I want to bring up just before we move on for quotability, and this isn't necessarily about quotability, it's about dialogue and the sort of lines that are written. So is this like a foreshadowing of the problem that recycling was going to have in the world? What is her deal with garbage at the start of the movie?
It was a weird kind of metaphor.
The metaphor works differently now because we've now moved on to this kind of weird recycling part. But I mean, write a film over 30 years ago and have the opening sort of dialogue mean something different now, but it still works. It's fucking see when you just write something that you it baffles me that he turned around a few years later and said they didn't like this film, because hopefully he reflects on it now and goes, holy shit, I've wrote something that people will watch forever, and the things will make loads of sense, but for different reasons.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a no for quotability. I'm sad to say, because there's nothing like massively standout-ish. But yeah, it's that real well-written film, though. There is some real kind of kooky conversations, which I quite like. But yeah, we move on to not well received by contemporary critics stroke reviewers. Now, this is a fucking a no, unfortunately. But yeah, it's got a 96% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, a 79% audience score. It currently holds a 7.2 on IMDb. It's also one of the few films that has got a really, really good Metacritic score. I think it's like in the 80%, which is the hardest. Rare. Kind of metric to judge. Legendary film reviewer Roger Ebert gave this film 3.5 out of 4. Empire magazine, which is a magazine that I've now started to get again, which I'm looking forward to getting more and more magazines back in the collection. 5 out of 5 by William Thomas, and Henry Barnes writing for the Guardian prefaced his article by saying it's his favourite Cannes winner of all time.
Yeah. At the time, it's still got a high rating now, and at the time, it was received very well at its initial release. So, yeah, like sometimes you just make a good film.
Sometimes you just get it right.
Sometimes it's like it's different. Sometimes you get those films where some people are like, well, especially with the cult films, you get the ones where those people are like, oh, I don't like this at all. You get some people who love it. This one was just an all around good film, so there's to find someone who didn't actually like it. I mean, of course, if it's not your type of film, then fair enough, but like that's different. That's just not not your type of film. That doesn't make it a bad film. It's just not for you.
See, that's the weird thing about, like, you think about doing a movie review, right, or a film review. How can you be objective rather than subjective? Like, do you get that good at it over a number of years where you can start to withhold your own bias towards something and still be able to give it credit for what it is?
I guess you can. I guess you're looking for certain things in a film, and if it hits those kind of things and just seems very solid. I don't know. Like, I feel like if there's a film that I wasn't as into, I'm probably going to rate it slightly less, because I usually, although I do look at a lot of aspects in a film, I also do rate a lot out of enjoyment as well. So if I'm not enjoying the film fully, I feel like it would probably still hinder my review. But I'd try not let it hinder. If it is a good film, I'd try not let it hinder too much.
I think it's a hard one, isn't it? Like, cause I think
it's a hard one, yeah.
Because I think these people are getting paid to give an opinion, aren't they? So,
well, yeah. So.
I mean, we're giving an opinion and we're currently not getting paid. If anybody would like to sponsor the podcast, please get in touch. We will take all the money available to give opinions. But, yeah, we do it out of the love of movies and film. I call it a movie, call it a film. It's a film in the UK. It's a movie in America. What would you call it, a film or a movie?
A change between.
See, it's weird. I hate, like, everything. Because it's prefaced that we are Cult Film Cafe, I always try and say film, but it's so hard to not say the word movie. This film, as I know, like, it was received well, and it's still received well over time. Next up, we have Exposed Controversial Topics, Subjects and Themes.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily is it controversial?
Probably not that controversial, I guess.
Was sex that much of a taboo subject even 30 years ago? Maybe, possibly, I don't
89?
know.
89? I mean, probably, that's probably the kind of time where it was getting less. So maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it isn't really that controversial then, yeah.
I mean, one of the central themes of the film is love over sex. I mean, it's kind of prefaced in the forefront. It's like this kind of split, when you look at it, Graham and Anne's character, they feel like they're trying to find love. whereas the other two, Cynthia and John, they're still acting on their baser urges for me. Like, it's all about physical attraction, and I think John's just a dick of a character, right? Let's just no beat around the bush. But Cynthia, over time in the film, and specifically after she has her conversation with Graham, I think her mindset might have started to shift. And it's quite ironic how he's able to do that to somebody, even though that they are having a conversation about her sex life.
Yes.
But I mean, I wouldn't necessarily sit and video somebody talking about their sex life, because it would make me feel uncomfortable. But there might be something intangible in a conversation like that, where once you get everything aired out in the open, that you might be able to process information differently. It's quite a strange one. Like, she's not a likable character. I mean, she obviously is not a likable character, because she's essentially sleeping with her sister's husband, and that's like, son, you shouldn't do. But I mean, quite like her.
She becomes very likable as the film goes on. But I don't know. I always felt from the start, I never fully disliked her. Like, I mean, she's sleeping with our sister's husband, which is pretty fucked up. But there's just something. I always feel like it was their relationship went. It wasn't just her being like a dick to Anne. I feel like it kind of went both ways. I feel like Anne felt beyond Cynthia a lot of times, and I could really see it in like their reactions, where I was kind of like, I feel like Anne's kind of being a dick about
exactly, because she's like, I don't want to be like my sister, and I'm like, but,
and it's like, it's kind
of
like,
there's nothing wrong with being a sexual person. It's just, right, should you have affairs with people? Probably not. But she does point out that he's the one that took a vow of marriage and she hasn't. I mean, would you fuck over your sister? I mean, I don't know if I'd want to fuck over anybody, but I mean, I think there's a sacred bond there. But he's the dick in this, you know what I mean? And to be honest with you, I feel as though he did have a lot of the power early on in the film, but she was the only person that would stand up to him and kind of just tell him to fuck off, you know what I mean? And there's something to like about that, you know? I don't necessarily think this film is inherently controversial. I think that there is people that maybe would watch this and be like, why would they do things like that? But I mean, it's not a controversial film. I just think it's about a subject matter that could be kind of off the table for a lot of people. You know, how many people are going to be sitting around talking about past sexual relationships and their sexual history? Probably not a lot, but I'm guessing it probably does happen amongst friends, you know? But
I guess the most controversial part of this film is the videotapes, probably, I guess.
Yeah, that's kind of weird, doesn't it? He doesn't let anybody else watch them. And I feel like a believer.
I think they're
like,
very open about that.
Very open about it. He's like, we have an agreement. The subject and I have an agreement, you know, that I wouldn't show it to anybody else. And that's fair. It seems like he sticks to it. And even though he is a pathological liar, I mean, I feel like he doesn't show the videotapes, but, you know, who knows? Anyway, that was a quick one. And then, lastly, we've got cultural impact and legacy. This is a weird one for me.
I'm not entirely sure. Like, it was, I mean, apparently it had a stage play.
The thing about it is like, so on past episodes, you know, Planet of the Apes, we spoke about, you know, the groundbreaking sci-fi of the 60s that went on to a number of sequels, and it, you know, had a reboot and, you know, a remake that didn't do, and you can look at the legacy and the impact of a franchise like that, or you can look at something like the MCU. But for me, without this film, now, there's obviously been loads of independent films made before this, but without this film, do we get the independent film boom of the early 90s? I'm not quite sure we do. So do we get the success of a Tarantino? Like, was this kind of the film that kind of was pushing the door open a bit, you know, and was successful enough and was made by this kind of up-and-coming movie director and who had his own voice and his own way of making films? So that's why I think it's got a legacy, and it was massively impactful for me. Because when you look at the sphere of cinema changing, there's got to be a point. And until now, we've not done a film like this where it's, I mean, we've done more independent, kind of smaller budget films. But I don't think we've done a film around about this time that was quite clearly an independent production that was picked up and distributed by Miramax.
Yeah.
Which, lo and behold, won the Audience Award at Sundance, which is a film festival where Reservoir Dogs done really well in 92. It also won the Palme d'Or in 89 at Cannes. And I'm pretty sure Pulp Fiction won the Palme d'Or in 94 at Cannes. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Do we get films like that in the forefront of culture without a film like this? Now, I'm not saying that this is a better film than those films. Like, it'll be interesting to see when we do episodes on both Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, because I'm pretty sure they're both on the list. Kill Bill's also on the list. I think Tarantino's the most featured director on this list. I think he's got 3 films on it. But like we preface, we don't make the list. I mean, I don't think I would pick 3 Tarantino movies, but anyway. And I'm not saying he wouldn't have made it, but he had struggles early on in his career. He couldn't get a project off the ground. He had to be a sort of TV actor. He was in an episode of the fucking Golden Girls as an Elvis impersonator. Like, but that was maybe in the late 80s, and maybe a film like this went, fuck, there's these young up-and-coming voices. We need to give them a platform. I mean, he's most famously known for selling the first ever script, True Romance, you know? Does a film like this, you know, I think so. Like, this is my opinion, and I could be wrong here. And I haven't studied the wider sort of history of film like, in depth. And maybe I'll get more and more knowledge as I do more and more of these episodes, where I do more and more research into the films. But just watching this film and knowing the timeline of when the film was released, I think it's done a lot for that part of the film industry.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it did have an effect. We'll never know, really, for sure, if it did. I mean, the only way to fully see it if you remove the film and made it, if you go into a different world where it didn't exist, I guess. I don't know. I guess nearly every film will have a big effect in certain ones over others. I mean, you could be right.
Well, how do you feel?
I don't know. Like, I'm not even sure. I'm not sure how much of an effect it would have on like other films. It depends. Like, I think some films it's obvious. Right? You're like, right, that obviously had a huge effect on some people, and it caused other films like this to get popular. It also caused other films to get made because of it. Whereas ones like this, I don't know. I mean, it kind of shows you what you can do with a small budget. I can tell you that much. But I'm honestly not too sure.
I also guarantee you that there's loads of people that try to rip this film off.
Yeah. What is this thing about Miramax trying to make an unofficial sequel?
I don't know. Like, it's something that I'm not 100% sure. Like, I know that there was talks about it.
Apparently, a film called Full Frontal. Oh, it got its name changed like multiple times. Wait, was it Steven Soderbergh? Yeah, it was. David Duchovny. Apparently, this is seen as a somewhat unofficial sequel for some reason, and I have no idea why. I know nothing about the film. Came out in 2002.
What? So, I mean, do we know?
It just said that they called it an unofficial sequel, but like, I don't know what that means. Yeah, but Miramax billed it as an unofficial sequel of sorts to Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Why does the Wikipedia page for that film not have a plot of it?
Yeah, it's really weird, eh? I don't know. I know nothing. I've never heard of this film. It had a budget of $2 million, made $30 million. So
I mean, the film blurs the lines between what is real and what is fiction, and its depiction of a film within a film. I mean, that sounds pretty cool, but I don't necessarily think you can have an unofficial to have a sequel to Sex Lies and Videotape. Yeah. You would need to have the same characters and stuff. I know that there's these fucking weird trilogies that people try and club together, or these sequels of films that they aren't the same film, but they've got similar tone and theme or whatever, you know. I wouldn't be able to comment. I've never seen Full Frontal. I mean, same director, obviously, but yeah, it might be. Weird, it doesn't. Like, I don't know what it's about.
What, is it just slightly like it? Is that what they're saying? I don't even know. It looks really weird. It made like no money. It was shot on a Canon XL1, and it was shot on digital, of course. Has quite a few, seems to have big names in it, including Brad Pitt. Yeah, I don't know. I just saw it on the page there, and I was kind of scanning through. Brad Pitt's playing himself. Wow.
Cultural impact and legacy. I'm going to give it a tick. I'm not sure about you for the film. I think without a film like this, I don't necessarily think the booming independent cinema comes. For me personally, but that's just based on very little knowledge. But watching this film and knowing exactly what it is and what came after, I feel as though I'm confident in it and that take. And if I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong, you know. Message us on Instagram and be like, Jonathan, you're stupid. That's not the case.
I think that's a very fair point. For me, I'm probably more like, I don't think it's got much of a legacy. I've not really heard much about this film. It could have, I had maybe heard a little bit more about it and stuff. I don't doubt that this could have caused like a lot of good things for like other independent films down the line, but I just feel like the film itself doesn't have that much of a legacy, which is quite weird. It's a very good film. It's another one of these nobody talks about films. Like, what other film were we talking about? It was 12 Monkeys, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Which is like a really good film, but like nobody talks about it. And it's quite bizarre. Kind of the fifth element a little bit as well. I know the fifth element a little bit more. People do talk about it. Was that one? There was another one, but yeah, just certain films just seem to start to disappear weirdly enough. I mean, I guess that's why it's been put on a cult poster, I guess, in the end. So yeah, for right now, I'd probably say that I'm kind of in the middle. I'm not really sure if I'm a yes or a no. I'd probably at the moment lean more to no.
I'm just looking at an article, and it's 25 years after its release, the film that sparked the indie film boom has plenty to say about gender dynamics. I'm confident in my take. I think it did start the indie film boom.
Fair enough.
So yeah,
I mean, it could have.
It is a yes from me. I'm so strong that I'm just giving it a yes for the podcast. Fuck Kenzie's dick. Anyway, that is it for the rules. Let's move on to the final act of the podcast, which is it based on the conversation that we've just had. Do we agree it's a cult film? And if so, does it deserve a place on our top 100 list? So yeah, it's a weird one. Like you preface, people don't really speak about this. Is it a cult film? Yes, for me it is.
Yes. Yes. It's a yes and a yes. We know what's happening here.
It's a yes and a yes. We'll just not beat around the bush. We're just like, yes, it's a cult film. Yes, it's going on both of our lists. It's going to be extremely high, probably on both of our lists.
Both of our lists, yeah.
This is a one,
like, if you're... Like, this could be, like, one of the first I could mention. Like, if I was mentioning cult films, this is probably one of the ones I'd probably bring up now.
Yeah.
But, like, true. Yo, you might want to check this one out. You'll probably quite like it.
Yeah, I agree.
Where would I have it? I think somewhere in the 20s. Why not? Like, let's go with a 24. Because we're talking about A24, yeah, fuck's sake. Let's go to 24.
Fair enough, put it at 24. I really like this film. I think it's probably one of the highest rated films for me, like 4.5. It could become a 5. It could actually become a 5 at some point.
That would be the first five on this part of the, well, for us on this, on the main podcast anyway.
No,
right?
I gave Godfather a five.
Oh, forgot about Godfather.
Did you not give something a five? No.
Nah, I don't think so.
You were talking about how Leon could potentially be a five at some point. Maybe that was it.
Yeah, I was like, it could get there. Yeah. Just, it wasn't.
I feel the same about this film. I mean, I gave The Godfather a five just because, for me, it's a great film. And I know you weren't on the podcast, but I know your views on the film. And obviously, Nick's views on the film. It's fine. I think, what was the other five we would give? What, the Claus, the animated Christmas movie?
Claus got a five, yeah.
From both of us.
But that's because that film's amazing.
That film is amazing.
Go and watch Claus. Well, wait till Christmas, but like, go and watch it if you haven't watched the Christmas episodes.
It's quite strange, yeah, giving things what out of five, you know. This could get to a five, but I'm still confident. It's at a 4.5. Do you know what? But I think the more and more I think about it, the more I'm like, I want it as close to number one as I can possibly get it. This is going inside my top 10. I think this is the first film to break my top 10.
I mean, I honestly, mine's could come lower. I just need to think about it. See, as we watch more films, that's when I feel this film going lower.
We've just done the recap episode, but I still can't remember anything.
I wrote it all down. I need to find a piece of paper. I don't know where I've put it. I made sure to take a note of all the ones that.
I'll need to do it. I'll need to get an Excel spreadsheet on the go and get everything put in, and so it's there and quite easy to see. I think this is a top 10. I think there's a few other films on the list yet to come that will break the top 10, but I'm quite happy to put this inside my top 10. I'll just put it at 10. Like, it's safe at 10 currently as a placeholder, but I want this firmly in my top 10, and I hope that it's still there when we do the 100 films. I fucking love this movie. And yeah, I don't know what else I can say, but yeah, it is a cult film, and we both have got it on our list. Go out and watch it. It's fucking amazing. Steven Soderbergh is a genius, directorial debut, and I'm right in saying it was the indie film that sparked the boom to come, and we got some amazing films out of that, which we will be coming on to talk about at some point in the near future. So if you have anything else you would like to say, or are we done on Sex, Lies and Videotape?
I think we've said more than enough about this film. Go and watch it.
Yeah, that's all we can say, and that's the glowing review of the film. Go and watch it. Not only did we both give it strong ratings, a 4 and a 4.5, we both have it firmly placed in our cult films list. So yeah, that is it for another episode. If you'd like to go and support the podcast, you can go and give us a follow over on Instagram and Twitter. We are at Cult Film Cafe on both of those. And if you'd like to check out past episodes, you can do so by searching for Cult Film Cafe wherever you get your podcasts. Yeah, go out and give us a wee listen and give us a wee follow or subscribe or whatever it is that you do on your app of choice. That is much appreciated. And it's an absolute pleasure, as always, to sit and talk about film. And it's even better when you get a film like this, which is an amazing piece of cinema. So it's a goodbye from me.
And it is a goodbye from me.
Podcast out.